This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Today, we are kicking off a new series called Law and Behold, aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. For today's first episode, I am joined by Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi. He's a professor of constitutional law, and Surendra Anand, the co-chairperson of the Malaysian Bar Constitutional Law Committee. And both of them will help us cut through the legalese and explain the meaning and significance of the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the Federation. Welcome, gentlemen. Surin, I think just to start off with, we all know this is part of a constitutional literary initiative. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yep. So it's the Constitutional Literacy Initiative. Essentially, it's a collaboration between the Malaysian Bar Constitutional Law Committee and the University of Malaya Law Faculty. So prior to this initiative, I think both sides have been doing a lot of awareness, campaigning and work on what the Constitution means. We've been organizing workshops on ad hoc basis towards different target groups. Mm-hmm. So we decided, why not combine our efforts together and have consistent aims and goals? Mm-hmm. And that's what we put together this initiative. And we had three main areas that we wanted to tackle. One is obviously the education sector towards high school and secondary, primary school students. And another one was towards the civil service. And the third and most important, or I guess equally important, is the public. Mm-hmm. And we thought one way to do it is through the talk show, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of people, we know the Constitution exists, but I don't think many people know or care to know about it.
Unless an issue comes up. Unless then something. Normally,
yeah. Then they're like, what does the Constitution say? Yeah. Okay, so that's the whole point of this. And we've got Professor Dr. Shad here as well. So today we're going to talk about the Constitution, its meaning and its significance. So Professor, maybe you can start, you know, give us some background to the Constitution. How was it even drafted in the first place?
Well, to begin with, let me say this, that constitutions are born to mark a progression in the evolution of a nation, sometimes after the defeat in war, as in Japan, or change of ideology, as happened in Iran, mm-hmm. after the fall of Shah of Iran, or to mark a stage in independence, as happened in Malaya, in India, in many of the Asian and African countries. Now, in many countries, when constitutions are being drafted, there is a lot of insistence that the constitution be crafted carefully by people who represent the population. Mm-hmm. In other words, the constituent assembly must be consisting of local experts who are representative. Malaya was very unique in that respect, that our members of the Reed Commission, five of them, were all foreigners.
Yep.
And there were no women on it. And the reason for that was that between the rulers and the members of the alliance, by alliance I mean the three major political parties, and the British, there was no agreement on who amongst the locals should represent the Reed Commission. So it was decided that perhaps one way to solve the difference of opinion would be to have all outsiders who would be given, however, some terms of reference.
Okay.
The alliance drafted terms of reference, and two Britishers, one a distinguished judge, one a distinguished constitutional law jurist, one Indian judge of the High Court, one retired Pakistani judge, and one Australian jurist. Mm-hmm. They were appointed, and then, of course, the work began.
And how long did it take for it to be drafted? I mean, was that a contentious sort of process? You know, it must have been, I mean, so many different people coming together, you know, a new country being formed, you know, what sort of troubles did they come across?
Of course. The drafting of any constitution is a
fraught
balancing act.
Okay.
You have to reconcile the irreconcilable sometimes. You have to try to reconcile. In the case of Malaya, the indigenous features of the Malaya archipelago, mm-hmm. there was strong insistence by UMNO, that those be preserved, by which I mean the Sultanate, Islam, Bahasa Melayu, special position of Malays, Malay reservation land, and some such features. At the same time, no constitution can be totally representative of existentialist realities. A constitution has to be idealistic. It has to have a vision of the future. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the British wanted to leave their legacy.
Of course.
So the Westminster system had to be emulated. Someone jokingly said the other day, is it the Westminster system or Westmonster system? We don't know. So anyway, the British had some ideas of what good governance should be. Then, of course, the rulers wanted their position to be preserved. So between the rulers and the Rakyat, the British and the Malayans, the Malays and the non-Malays, and in 1963, the Borneo states, the former Borneo states and the peninsula states, they all had to come together to arrive at some core features on which they could agree. Mm-hmm. So the Constitution was a balancing act. But I have to say this, that in some respects, the Constitution of Malaya and later on of Malaysia is a remarkable document in the sense that its overall spirit is one of accommodation, mm-hmm. of compromise, of moderation and tolerance.
Okay, and I mean, that is why we want to talk about this, why we're doing this whole series, right? We want people to understand all those things that you spoke about and its meaning and significance. So, but why do you think it's important? And this is an issue that I think the literacy initiative is. Why do you think Malaysians need to understand the constitution and the role that it plays? I mean, in their daily lives, you know, how does it actually play a role?
Right. So I think just before we go there quickly, just to give a very snippet of what the constitution is. Like Prof said, it's a foundational document that provides how the country is to be run. Mm-hmm. And for that purpose, it provides for the setting up of multiple state institutions. You have judiciary, the parliament, the executive, the election commission, the attorney general, and it provides for certain rights for the people and sure. certain groups. Now, if I were to take the constitution and go to a layperson, he will most probably say, look, how does this concern me?
Yes.
I mean, politicians run the country to the government, parliament makes law, the judiciary implements the law, and, you know, they are more directly relevant to these people. Mm-hmm. So that's the first part. It is indirectly relevant to the public simply because an informed citizen would want to know that these institutions are being run properly in accordance with the constitution. So let's just take an example. Most probably, no one really cared on how the prime minister was appointed up until the last election, when there was this uncertainty about how Tun M was to be appointed. Then suddenly, you notice everyone wanted to know, hey, what is the process and appointment of a prime minister, which is in the constitution? Or, for example, when the AG was to be appointed, the attorney general, and there was a bit of uncertainty there. And then now everyone also wanted to know, is there a race requirement to become an AG? How does the process work? Can the previous AG just be removed? Appointment. So when the issue comes up, political issues, then the constitution becomes very relevant. The second aspect is, and I think this goes unnoticed a lot, is fundamental rights. The constitution has a specific and dedicated chapter or part on fundamental liberties. Mm-hmm. And these are liberties that belong to all. Two provisions are only to citizens, but the rest, or sorry, three, but the rest is to all persons. And we are not taught about this so much in our primary and secondary school, and that's really the point. If I knew I had the freedom to profess the religion when I was young, I would walk into class with a lightsaber and say that I'm like part of the force or something. I didn't know about it. I only knew about it because I read and studied law.
Sure.
But these are rights that belong to all, and I think we should know about it.
Mm-hmm. So essentially you're saying that it just lays the foundations for our existence, basically, in this country as residents of Malaysia, in that sense.
Yeah, that's a very simple way of putting
it. Very simple, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, but we also want to know how the constitution set up the structure of the state. So, I mean, what are the main branches? What are the institutions of the state? You know, how does everything sort of work together?
Well, as Suren said, it's the foundational law. It's the basic law. As the nicety say, it's the law of laws. Mm-hmm. It's the Grundnorm, the basic rule. It's the highest law. It's superior to all pre-independence laws. It is superior to post-independence laws. It is superior to the laws of Parliament, the laws of the state assemblies. The laws may be made by the Yang Di Pertuanagong under emergency proclamation. So it's the highest law of the land. And being the highest law of the land, it cannot be amended in the same easy manner that you can amend, let us say, the Road Traffic Act.
Right.
So the Constitution will provide for its fundamental postulates. It will also provide a procedure for its amendment. In some countries like Australia, if you want to amend the Constitution, you have to go for a referendum. Mm-hmm. In the USA, if you have to amend the Constitution, you have to get the consent of 3/4 of the 50 state assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be 37.
Mm-hmm.
In Malaysia, we have a different procedure. There are actually 5 separate ways of amending the Constitution. But in general, the common procedure is 2/3 majority of the total membership in the Dewan Rakyat and the Dewan Negara,
mm-hmm,
at both the second and the third readings. In other words, twice in each house. So the Constitution is the highest law because it not only provides the basic structure of the state. Actually, it provides, as Suren said, fundamental rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish to add that point. It supplies the values of the body politic. It supplies the delicately arrived at compromises. So that's why it should not be amended easily, because there were nearly 120 meetings of the Reid Commission,
mm-hmm,
before they drafted the Constitution. And of course, behind the scenes, the Alliance had untold number of meetings. So the Constitution, in some respects, actually represents the value system of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sadly, our Constitution doesn't have a preamble, as most constitutions do, because the values are distilled in a preamble. But it doesn't matter. The values are implicit, and they are found in the 183 articles. Suren, for example, pointed out, there is a chapter on fundamental liberties.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chapter on judicial independence. There are provisions on elections. Now, these are clearly indicative that this was meant to be a democratic setup, a constitutional monarchy, a parliamentary democracy, a country with some provision for limiting the power of the state and respecting the rights of the citizens.
Mm-hmm. So a very people-centered system of law, could you say that?
Well, yes. People, being people-centered is certainly an important aspect of the Constitution. But in the case of Malaysia, because at that time we were under the dark shadow of emergency,
mm-hmm,
therefore a whole chapter on special powers against subversion and emergency were included. And that created a dilemma of how the might of the state and the rights of the citizens must be balanced. And maybe at some other session we'll discuss as to whether the balance worked well or not.
Okay. There's a lot more to discuss there. I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law, and Surendra Anand, the co-chairperson of the Malaysian Bar Constitutional Law Committee. And this is our new series to help us all understand the Constitution better. It's called Law and Behold, and we'll continue our discussion on the meaning and significance of the Constitution after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. This is our new series, Law and Behold, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. And we hope this series will, you know, help us all understand our country's constitution better. And joining me to help do that are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law from the University of Malaya, and Surendra Anand, the co-chairperson of the Malaysian Bar Constitutional Law Committee. So all these institutions that you spoke about earlier, I mean, they are separate, but they are still independent. Am I correct?
Yes.
So how are these intergovernmental relationships actually managed?
Well, the Constitution supplies the basic relationship between the citizen and the state, between the various organs of the state, so executive and legislature, legislature and the judiciary, and between the legislature, Dewan Rakyat and Dewan Negara, between the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, Prime Minister and the Yang Di Pertuanagong and the Majlis Raja Raja, Conference of Rulers. It's a number of institutions runs into scores, actually. And their relationship with each other and with the citizen is outlined mm-hmm. in the Constitution. But of course, once in a while, disputes will occur. Disagreements will occur. And that's where the role of an independent judiciary is. The judges have the power to blow the whistle, if I may put it that way, or to show the red card or the yellow card, as in soccer, to say your action is contrary to the Constitution.
Just to add on to Prof as well, I mean, like you said, the Constitution is a basic document. There's a lot more things that need to be put into words as well. So for that, we have Parliament. Mm-hmm. Parliament makes the law. Mm-hmm. But who's going to actually implement the law?
Yep.
Then you have your government. So the government's actions are based on written law, which mm-hmm. are made by Parliament. But what if Parliament steps outside its boundaries? What if the government steps outside its boundaries? What if it starts oppressing the people? Who is to do something about it? And like Prof said, that's why you have the judiciary, which is there to uphold the rights of the people and the Constitution. And then another main institution is the Election Commission, which is also provided for.
Yeah.
So we have our elections, we have our boundaries, where you vote for, which polling station you go to. And for that purpose, you have the Election Commission. Then the fifth main one as well is the Attorney General. The government needs a legal advisor, and for that you have the Attorney General.
Mm-hmm. So in the managing of all of this is basically everyone is keeping everyone in check.
Exactly. And the Constitution is that document which everyone refers to.
The highest law as it is.
May I at this point clarify, you know, in many democracies, they talk of separation of powers.
Yeah.
A much better word is balance of powers or check and balance, because in our parliamentary system, executive and legislature are not separated.
Mm-hmm.
The Prime Minister and the Cabinet sit in Parliament, are answerable to it, accountable to it, and must supply information, justify policies during question time. In fact, the Prime Minister and the Cabinet can be voted out on a vote of no confidence,
mm-hmm.
something that's not possible in the USA.
Mm.
The president is quite free of the Congress. The Congress cannot dismiss him except through impeachment and conviction, which has never happened in 230 years of American history. It was attempted twice,
yes.
but it didn't succeed. So we have a check and balance, and I think that's good. Power checks power.
Mm-hmm.
We can, in many areas, by we I mean the various branches of the state, we can work together. We can share powers. For example, Parliament is not always able to have the time to pass laws, so it delegates to the executive
mm-hmm.
the power to make delegated legislation. But ideally, Parliament should keep an eye on what the delegate makes. And this is called scrutiny committees.
Mm-hmm.
In the House of Commons in England or in India. We don't have them as yet, but I do hope that with a new speaker committed to the Constitution, committed to restoring Parliament's prestige and dignity, I hope we'll soon have a scrutiny committee in the Dewan Rakyat and Dewan Negara, whereby when the Parliament delegates, it doesn't amount to abdicates. In other words, it keeps a check on what the delegate is doing.
Mm-hmm. So we've not seen that happen before then? We don't have a scrutiny committee?
We don't have a scrutiny committee as yet. But I'm not worried about that. I'm not pessimistic. 60 years is not a long time in the life of a nation. So I think we are conscious of what needs to be done in terms of reform, and I do hope and pray that these reforms will come. What's very important is that organizations like yours, in other words, the media, you are now going to play a role. You are playing a role because ultimately the working of the Constitution depends not only on the government, it depends on the people.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Constitution we deserve, and I hope that our sessions with you will emphasize to our fellow citizens that the job of reviving the Constitution, of respecting its values and trying to achieve its ideals, is not a job only of the government. We all have a role to play.
Mm-hmm. And I think a very important aspect for regular folk like myself, for example, is how human rights are addressed, or protected under the Constitution. Could you walk me through that? You know, why was it important to include human rights in the Constitution in the first place?
Well, the approach of the Malaysian Constitution was, to some extent, shaped by the humanitarian tradition of the era after World War II, the atrocities in Germany and during World War II. Mm-hmm. So we have a chapter on fundamental liberties that Suren pointed out, Articles 5 to 13. Article 5 is personal liberty. Article 6 is abolition of slavery and forced labor. Article 7 says criminal law should not be backdated. No one should be punished again and again for the same offense. Article 8 is equality. 9 is freedom of movement. 10 is speech, assembly, association. 11 is religion. 12 is education. 13 is right to property. I have to quickly add, elsewhere also in the Constitution, there is protection of rights. For example, civil servants cannot be dismissed without a proper hearing, Article 135. They are eligible for pension. Natives of Sabah, Sarawak, Orang Asli. So the Constitution is actually enriched by many other provisions where there are rights. Now, the approach of the Malaysian Constitution is this, that in some provisions, rights are given. In other provisions, Parliament is given the power to restrict these rights.
Okay.
So take, for example, freedom of religion, Article 11. All persons have right to practice, propagate, and subject to some limitations to preach their religion to others. However, Parliament has the power by law to restrict all religions on grounds of public order, public health, and morality.
Okay.
So, if taking vaccinations or inoculations is against my freedom of religion, I'm sorry, I have to give way to public health.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The government can insist through law that vaccinations must be taken. If a religious practice is generally regarded by society as immoral, then that religious practice has to give way. So Parliament has the power to regulate even the most sensitive of rights, that is freedom of religion. So rights are given with one hand, power is given to the state with the other to restrict these rights. So there must be a balance. And if the balance does not exist, or if the government goes too far or citizens go too far, then, as Suren pointed out, judges have to step in with that whistle or with that red card to say, you have violated the law.
And I guess also an important question also is, why is it, do we need it to be there in the Constitution,
yeah,
as opposed to any other law? Well, like Prof pointed out, if it was not there in the Constitution, we would require some sort of positive act from the state, realistically, through some law to give us those rights.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, it being in the Constitution, it's status quo that we enjoy these rights unless otherwise properly taken away by Parliament. So like Prof said, to amend the Constitution, you need a two-third majority.
Yeah.
While there is some argument to be made that they can't amend fundamental liberties, but that's maybe for another time, it's a bit complicated. But I think that's what we need to understand. And when you talk about restrictions, the more general ones, like Prof pointed out, was public order, national security. And we see these words coming out a lot, especially with the previous administration on the National Security Council Act. There were threats on ISIS and et cetera, et cetera. What's important to understand is when you talk about these restrictions, it is not the subjective or the government's own interpretation of what national security or public order means.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, you need to look at it from a neutral, objective standpoint, from the facts. So this is I'll just give a very, very simple example. I'm going to go back to Star Wars again because I'm a Star Wars fan.
Evidently.
So let's just say I wanted to wear a lightsaber and a Jedi robe or whatever and go out because that's part of my...
I look forward to that.
The next interview.
I forgot I'm saying it on air.
Please do this, Suren, for the next interview.
Right. So let's say that's part of my expression and that's part of my religion. And now the government can't come and tell me, look, we don't recognize this religion, or we don't really like this expression of yours, so we're going to restrict it.
Mm.
They can't do that. But what they can do is, if I start wielding my lightsaber around in public, which then might harm other people, and I say, well, that's part of my religion, why can't I do it? Then the government can step in and say, hold on, well, that might be part of your religion, but you are now affecting other people. You might harm other people. So there's an objective standard that you need to apply before these restrictions of public order or national security is engaged. Mm-hmm. So the point is, status quo, we have that right. Mm-hmm. If you want to take it away, you show us good reasons on why you're taking it away, mm-hmm. by reference to these objective factors.
Right. So it can't just be like a sweeping decision that I don't like it, so I'm just going to tell you.
No, yes, no. Freedoms are inherent. Mm-hmm. It is power that needs legal justification.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I have a right to express my personality in any way possible, save to the extent that I don't cross the borders of the law.
Okay.
So in a democracy, it's not power that is inherent, as you said. You don't like it, so you will not allow me that. Mm. No, that's not the assumption of democracy. Assumption of democracy is that all power must be derived from the law.
Okay.
If I walk on the streets without a tie and a policeman stops me and says, hey, you, where's your tie? I'm entitled to ask, hey, you, which law says I must wear a tie?
Mm-hmm. And that's why
he has to justify his restriction rather than me justifying my action of dressing in a collarless shirt.
Sure. And then that's why we need to know about the Constitution,
yes,
and
indeed.
what our rights are. So let's go back to your example as a Jedi, right? So let's say you are walking around the streets as a Jedi and, you know, they come after you and say, stop it. And then what sort of legal recourse do you have to fight for that right to remain as a Jedi?
Well, that depends on what action they're going to take. So, for example, if they're going to punish me for some crime, mm-hmm. I can't think of any, to be honest.
public nuisance, I don't know.
I suppose, perhaps public nuisance.
Yeah.
Well, then you can challenge that particular action in court. Or, for example, you can always go to court and get a declaration that that's just part of my religion or whatever. I don't think anyone has ever done it, to be honest. And religion is always a very, very
tricky,
sensitive
one,
and volatile concept. But let's say expression, for example.
Expression
is something which is a bit more simple. So you have this lot of things going around by saying sensitive words, insulting people, etc., etc. Let's just be clear. Insulting a particular individual is not an offense.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be a valid restriction.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if something goes to the extent of potentially causing public disorder, then maybe, yeah. So this is a simple example. Let's say right now in this room, there's me, there's you, Juliet, and there's Prof. Shard. Let's say if I start insulting religion in this private room. Now, that to me is not it is a valid exercise of free speech, because
sure.
I have two people who are matured, who are from educated background, and you all understand. You all might feel offended by it. You might walk out of the room. You might call me rude, but that's it. Now, if I had said the same thing, let's say in a temple or a mosque, a group of people.
Public space.
Yes. Then there might be a valid basis for a public order concern, mm-hmm. which might warrant my speech to be restricted.
Okay. And again, this goes back to the Constitution. It goes back to the highest law that is there that gives you
Which gives you that rights, yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something there. When we talk of human rights, we have to bear in mind a few things, challenging things. One is that human rights are a journey, not a destination.
Mm.
The concept of human rights is expanding. It's very fascinating, actually. And since World War II, we have had new dimensions added. So we used to talk of civil and political rights,
mm-hmm.
right to speech, women's right to vote, right to due process. In other words, you should get a fair hearing in a court. No arbitrary arrest. These are called civil and political rights. But the experience of much of Asia and Africa was poverty, homelessness, no water, no food. So human rights acquired a second dimension, the socioeconomic dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Now human rights are acquiring a third dimension of sustainable development. So human rights are progressing. And I just wanted to add this, that though both Suren and I talked about Articles 5 to 13, we have to caution you. The Constitution does not mention most of the socioeconomic rights.
Right.
There's no mention of food or water or jobs or housing or medicine or roads. But very quickly, I must add, many of these are provided for by ordinary law. Now, why is that so? Why is it not in the Constitution? I think because socioeconomic rights have massive economic implications. Mm-hmm. So if the Constitution were to say everyone has a right to shelter and a place above his head, then people will go to the courts. And if there is no money to provide housing, what can the government do? So in many countries, the approach is to take care of the citizens' welfare, a welfare state or socioeconomic justice, by providing for it through ordinary laws,
okay,
which can be amended, repealed, or enacted by ordinary procedure.
Mm-hmm. And I guess just to conclude, I want to find out more about legal pluralism.
Always a difficult one.
Pluralism. Legal pluralism. Malaysia is one of the many countries, as you've mentioned to me before, that practices that. What does that mean, and how does that work in Malaysia?
Well, we are a country with dazzling diversity.
Yes.
We are a country like the colors of a rainbow. Many colors, and the various communities in some respects are separate, hopefully not apart. Separate but not apart. Now, we have to accept this reality that though we may be nationalistic in the sense that we regard ourselves as Malaysians, at the same time, I think it's natural for people to have loyalty and affection and desire to preserve their culture, their language, their religion, their link up with a particular sect. In other words, we all have multiple identities. We all stand at the center of a large number of circles of loyalty. Now, a democratic legal system, while promoting unity, must promote unity, which does not necessarily mean uniformity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It must promote unity in diversity, which means that people's deep-seated values must be respected. Religion is one of them. Culture, language are another. So I think a good democratic legal system, a legal system that is in the long range likely to produce harmony, is if there is no attempt at imposing an artificial uniformity.
Okay.
That's where legal pluralism comes in. You allow different cultures, different languages, different religions, not only to thrive, to exist and thrive, but also you allow people to resolve their disputes under those systems. So you may have, in this country, for example, we have civil courts, we have Sharia courts, and we have native courts in Sabah, Sarawak. So that's legal pluralism. A number of streams of laws, mm-hmm, number of systems of courts, number of systems of dispute resolution. And I think that's part of the richness of a nation. Nothing to be frowned upon or to be concerned about. Though I acknowledge once in a while when you have several streams, they clash.
Yeah.
Well then, that's our challenge then, to try to reconcile these clashes, mm-hmm, with the least friction and waste.
Okay, I think we see that in, we saw that in cases of like unilateral conversions, for example,
yes,
that
indeed,
whole battle between Sharia and,
yeah.
But how does the Constitution come into situations like that, for example?
So I suppose like Prof said, the starting point is that legal pluralism, when I get it, so difficult. Anyway, yeah, so it operates in a very small circle. You have your general laws, like I said, Parliament made and contract criminal, mm-hmm, so the general stuff applies to everyone across the board.
Sure.
But certain religions, like Muslims, for example, they have Islamic law that governs the personal sphere, marriage, divorce, matrimonial property, certain offences against the precepts of Islam, etc., etc. So it covers one small area. Now, there might be instances where these laws might, as you said, clash with the general civil law. So, for example, if it's a unilateral conversion, it's normally the right of the parent to choose the religion of the child, the right of the child, and freedom of religion sometimes also interposes into the larger problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we need to understand is personal laws or personal Islamic law in this sense is made by the state. Each state has their own Islamic law. And like we said at the beginning of the show, ultimately, all the laws that are made either by the state or by parliament must conform two fundamental liberties. So when there's a clash in that sense, the right of a parent to choose the religion of the child, in this sense, both parents. And then if you have a particular law saying that you can convert, a single parent can convert the child, then that clash must be resolved in favor of the fundamental right of both parents, for example. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is you can have all these laws, no issue, but you need to respect what the Constitution says.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. I think we had a remarkable, admirable case in 2018,
yep.
the Indira Gandhi case,
yes.
decided by Justice Zainon, where this unilateral conversion issue was resolved. And I think what comes out of this case, one of the points that emerges is this, that if one of the parties to a dispute is not a Muslim, then the Sharia authorities and the Sharia courts should not exercise jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
When both parties are Muslims and the topic is within the jurisdiction of the Sharia court, then Sharia courts exercise jurisdiction. But if one party is not a Muslim, then the ecclesiastical courts of one community should not have jurisdiction over a person belonging to another faith. So in the case of Indira Gandhi, the civil courts decided that both parents must have a say in the religion of the child.
Yeah.
The action of the director of conversions,
yeah.
I forget what was his official name, but the registrar.
Yeah, the Mu'allaf, as they call it.
The registrar of Mu'allafs. His actions were contrary to the state law, contrary to the federal constitution. It took a long time for this decision to be made. Indira Gandhi's first case went to the court, I think, in 2009.
Yeah, it was 10 years. Yeah.
And then finally she got justice in the courts in 2018. So it took, 10 years. Sadly, she has not yet been reunited with her child. So that's now the execution of the judgment.
Okay. Yep. All right. Thank you so much, gentlemen. So we're going to continue this series. It's going to be lots and lots of topics. It's going to be quite a lot to go through. So we look forward to that. Thank you both for joining me today.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure being with you.
That was Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Surendra Anand, the co-chairperson of the Malaysian Bar Constitutional Law Committee, on our first episode of Law and Behold, a new series which will dissect the constitution and hopefully improve, our constitutional literacy for all Malaysians. If you miss any part of this interview, you can always search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store, and you can also find us on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.